Welcome back to the program. I'm Michael Cohen with producer Desi Simmons. While officials at UAW have been hard to get a hold of, or rather impossible, the union did in fact ratify a new contract with General Motors with 65% of its production workers supporting the deal. To talk about the details of the contract, I'm joined by Kristen Dechek. She's the director of the Labor and Industry Group at the Center for Automotive Research, and she read through the over 500-page contract. Thank you very much for joining me, Kristen.
You're welcome. It's nice to be with you.
Now, 35% of the UAW rejected the deal. Is that a relatively high proportion of workers voting no on a contract?
Not really. I mean, this is really a solid margin for the contract. And, you know, employers seem to think that if the ratification percentage is too high, they gave too much away. And if it's too low, then the union feels that they didn't get enough. And I think this is a solid middle of the ground margin, and it passed by significant proportion.
Now, many of the UAW workers did feel that they should have gotten more from GM. Where would you say the contract fell short for UAW workers?
Well, I think workers would always like to see things come in terms of annual improvement factors that compound over time. So they would like to see raises rather than these lump sums that are included in this contract. I think, you know, Wall Street was watching this contract very closely, as were other policymakers, to see if the post-bankruptcy had changed attitudes in Detroit at all. And I think, you know, this move toward lump sums and things that don't compound over time and holding the line on costs. You know, GM estimates their costs only increase about 1% over the life of this contract. Will do a lot to help the financial markets see GM as a strong company.
Now, under the deal, as you said, which runs through 2015, most workers will not get an annual pay raise. Is this the first time we've seen such a thing?
No, there were no annual raises in the 2007 agreement either. And lump sums in that agreement, two of them were postponed and, you know, didn't materialize again in the 2009 reopener.
Entry-level workers who now make a base wage of around $15.78 per hour will get a 22% raise. While that's certainly a win, aren't they still going to be making about half of what veteran workers are earning?
They do, but they get the full lump sums, they get the full profit-sharing payout, they get the full signing bonus, and this year alone, I think that adds up to, you know, just a little bit north of $9,000, which is a significant portion of the first-tier workers' pay.
In the concessions that the union made during the bankruptcy, how much of those concessions did they get back in this contract?
Well, the right to strike is back. That is a one-shot deal, and that only happened in this contract negotiation. So the binding arbitration clause has not continued. They suspended COLA, and it remains suspended. The jobs bank has been eliminated completely. So those are some of the major concessions made in 2009, and those, we've got a mixed bag.
And when you look at what union negotiators walked away with and what you would consider big wins for the union, what would those be in this contract?
You know, sometimes when you don't lose, you win. And I think that, you know, we'll see as the rest of the negotiations play out at the other companies, you know, what else might be possible. But there were no cuts in healthcare, and that was a strong push from the employer side to, you know, get some movement to cost sharing. Cost sharing doesn't lower costs at all. So I think, you know, the union resisted that. They also, you know, really went to bat for raising the wage for the entry-level workers and putting more emphasis on profit sharing as a more simplified formula based on North American profits. And in the mid-range of expected profitability, it actually pays out more than the previous formula would have.
I'm talking to Kristen Dechek. She's the director of the Labor and Industry Group at the Center for Automotive Research. Now, I'm going to guess this contract then is, in general, far less generous than the ones that we saw pre-bankruptcy then. Is that right?
Well, you know, there have been some very generous contracts pre-bankruptcy. I think 2007, you know, had two really monumental changes, the Retiree Healthcare Trust and the institution of the second tier. And I think, you know, those were pretty tough pills to swallow for the membership. And this, you know, accepts those two changes going forward, but puts a lot more cash in members' pockets and a lot more jobs in the plants. And I think, you know, now that we have had a correction and the balance sheets look a lot stronger, profitability is more likely and the growth of jobs is more likely. So, you know, I think that's good for the communities and places where these plants are located.
What about job security and job growth? Was it firmly established in this contract?
Well, job security has sort of morphed, and in 2007, the UAW still had the jobs bank language in place, but they also went after specific investments tied to plants and products, product commitments to plants, and a lot of those actually came true. And when you look through the history of, you know, what did they promise and what did they deliver on those, given the fact that there was a bankruptcy in the middle of that contract, so many of those things actually came to fruition. And I think that's the new form of job security, is getting a viable product committed to your plant, getting investment in the plant, and having job growth come from those products being successful in the market.
It looks like UAW negotiations with Chrysler and Ford are going to be a bit more complicated. How do you see the unfolding of negotiations with these two remaining automakers?
Well, Ford seems like they're in the home stretch now. If all indications are true, we may see something from Ford in the next couple of days. And, you know, Ford really needed to see the GM agreement first and see, you know, what did they have to meet or beat. And I would expect it to look very much like the GM agreement, with perhaps a little bit more in the signing bonus, a very similar change in the profit-sharing program to this simplified chart, and some more, you know, job and investment commitments on the other side. So I would see, you know, cash in people's pockets and some more jobs.
And on Chrysler's end, I know that's been a bit contentious.
The only thing certain about Chrysler is whatever Mr. Marchionne does, he will be wearing a black sweater. He has proven that he's, you know, the only CEO who's intimately involved in the negotiations with the union, and Chrysler has some really different situations that they would like some accommodation for. So, you know, it remains to be seen what happens at Chrysler. I think the union will try to hold true to their pattern, because they don't like to have any one automaker have a competitive advantage on labor costs given to them by the union. So, you know, we have to see how much the suit can shrink down to Chrysler's size.
The fundamental changes we saw during the bankruptcy, then, when it comes to the contract that exists between the unions and the automakers, are we likely to never go back to what we saw ahead of that, even if automakers begin to be successful, wildly successful in the coming years?
I think the only way we see a return to what we had before, if, you know, amid wildly successful companies, is if the strength of the union is rebuilt. And I think, you know, the leadership of the UAW understands that, and they're working to increase the membership and to organize some of the non-union transplant manufacturers here in the U.S. and suppliers as well. Only when they become wage setters do they have the power to control, to go back to the types of contracts that they had before and to erase some of the concessions that were made.
I wanted to ask you about something that Republican lawmakers are very interested in, which is right-to-work legislation, which is now being considered at the Capitol. If we do see something like that pass and union dues do become optional, do you think that would have a substantial weakening effect on the UAW in Michigan?
You know, it could. It very well could. And I think that, you know, the union, when you realize the value of having a union is when you're not in one. And I, you know, I think that that will play itself out, and, you know, we may see it, you know, go one way and then come back the other. You know, I don't really, you know, want to say how, you know, how much it's going to impact, but it will definitely have an impact on the union movement in Michigan.
And finally, once a contract is reached and this one runs into 2015, basically at this point, there shouldn't be any further concerns the union will have. It'll be just moving ahead and building cars?
It should be smooth sailing in terms of the labor agreement being set for the next 4 years. Of course, the last two national agreements have reopened. The 2003 agreement reopened in 2005 to initiate the first VBAs, or Voluntary Employee Benefit Association for Retiree Healthcare, and then 2007 reopened in the midst of the bankruptcy crisis. I don't know that we have any of those things on the horizon going forward. So, you know, reopeners are possible, but I don't foresee anything like that.
Kristen Dechek, Director of the Labor and Industry Group at the Center for Automotive Research. Thank you for joining me.
You're very welcome.
And we'll be right back with more. I'm Michael Cohen. You're listening to 1320 WILS.